From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Tens of millions of Americans are enduring the coldest weather in a generation. In Chicago today, a bone-chilling minus 49 with wind chill. That meant yesterday, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker ordered a state disaster proclamation.
This storm poses a serious threat to the well-being of people all across our state. And for those reasons, I am issuing a disaster proclamation so that the state of Illinois can use every tool at our disposal to provide relief to our residents and to keep them safe.
Well, the entire Midwest is facing dangerously low temperatures as a polar vortex freezes the region, stopping mail, canceling school, grounding flights, even threatening lives. This hour on Point, the hows, the whys, and how to endure the polar vortex. And you can join us if you're enduring those super cold temperatures today. How are you faring? How have you been preparing? Are you looking after or helping to look after your less fortunate residents? What's it like to face this cold? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And a little later this hour, we're going to take a look at the lasting effects of the government shutdown on America's national parks. That's later in the program. But first, let's talk right about that cold weather. And joining us from Chicago is Tom Skilling, chief meteorologist at WGN-TV, where he's been forecasting the weather for the past 40 years. Tom, welcome to the program.
Meghna, a pleasure to be with you. And it is cold out here this morning, Meghna. 23 below is our current temperature, and we have a wind chill of 51 below. And you know, Meghna, to put this in some sort of historical perspective, there we have 54,020 temperatures on record here going back to 1870, and this is only the 17th time of all those temperatures that we've had a reading of 20 below zero. It will also be only the third time that we've had back-to-back nighttime lows of 20 below or colder, because we're expecting another sub-zero reading tonight. We broke a half-century-old record this morning. We'll break a record for the coldest high temperature today. We're expecting only 14 degrees below zero as a daytime high today, and then 26 below tonight. It's unimaginable. I'm looking out on Lake Michigan, which looks like a boiling cauldron as this Arctic air hits the open water. Steam is rotating up. Buildings are creaking and popping. We're getting sun dogs. These suspended ice crystals in this Arctic air produce halos around the sun. So there are optical effects with this as well.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it sounds like a cold apocalypse, honestly, Tom. But how long is this expected to last?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This has come on quickly. It will end quickly. In fact, by this weekend, we're expecting a 69-degree temperature increase between tomorrow's 26 below and the 43 that we expect. That's 43 above with rain, if you can believe that, on Sunday. So we're going to emerge from this quite dramatically.
Wow. I mean, so that might be great for people. And, of course, we are concerned about people's well-being across the Midwest. But I can't imagine those giant temperature swings are good for infrastructure. I mean, how is the city of Chicago ready or dealing with the effects of the cold on the city and this giant temperature swing you're talking about that's on the way?
So true. You know, it's amazing. The resources of government, every level of government, our mayor, Mayor Emanuel, our governor, all have been on the air and in media in every way, shape, and form they can to inform the public. We have homeless in this city, as we do in all cities. There's an effort to get these folks into shelter. You know, Meghna, it's a sad fact that people will die during this. They do during these cold waves. The hope here is to minimize loss of life. And, of course, we've got another issue. This cold air is hitting with wind.
Yeah.
So this is creating ground blizzard conditions in some of the rural roads surrounding here. And that's been true from Minnesota through Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana. Open areas. So many, many ways in which this is affecting us. But heating centers have been open.
Mm-hmm.
We have some experience with cold weather. We had two mornings in 1982 that went down to 26 below. And our coldest temperature in the city's record books was the 27 below on January 20th, 1985. So it's been a while since we've had anything this cold, about 3.5 decades. But we have some experience dealing with this, and loss of life and injury is an obvious risk, and we're trying to mitigate that.
Yeah.
So are officials out here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to, since you mentioned the dangers for homeless Chicagoans, I just want to play a little bit of tape here, because Nancy Powers of the Salvation Army is one of, many volunteers in Chicago who are trying to help the homeless there. She spoke to CBS reporter Dean Reynolds just a couple of days ago.
Are you concerned that people are going to die here?
We are very concerned. We offer them shelters, we offer them the warming centers, and we'll drive them there.
So that's Nancy Powers of the Salvation Army. WGN reporter Nancy Liu talked about how the cold has affected Chicago's most vulnerable populations.
There are over 4,000 beds for the homeless, and last night they were at capacity, coincidentally, just as the deep freeze set in the city.
So Tom Skilling, also at WGN-TV, I presume people are just being advised not to go outdoors at all.
That's exactly right. And further, we're advising folks not drive in open areas because of this ground blizzard risk. Yeah, this is really brutal. I went outside just to video the lake. I'm telling you, my skin froze in literally a few seconds out there. This
wow.
is brutal cold and very, very dangerous. And, you know, it's interesting when you look at this air mass relative to the rest of the planet, we are probably the coldest spot on Earth in terms of being below our normal here. There's no other spot that's more below its normal temperature. There's another lobe of cold air over eastern Siberia. So that area and here in the Midwest are the coldest areas on the planet. And the interesting thing is, much of the rest of the planet is above normal
mm-hmm.
in terms of temperature. So this is a fairly compact area, but it's a broad area. And there are some real issues with this.
Well, Tom Skilling, chief meteorologist at WGN-TV in Chicago, who's been forecasting the weather for 40 years. Tom, thank you so much, and stay safe, okay?
Thank you, Meghna. Nice to talk to you.
All right. Well, let's actually go to some calls here. So we got listeners across the Midwest are experiencing this. Let's go to Tushar, who's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Tushar, how cold is it where you are?
Well, hello, and I just want to make a quick point to the rest of my brothers and sisters in the Midwest to stay warm. In Dayton, Ohio right now, according to my phone, it is negative 27 degrees outside. All of the schools, all of the universities in my area and all of the public schools in the state of Ohio are closed. But I want to bring attention to the last polar vortex that came through in 2014. The Ohio State University was, when I was attending there in 2014, it was not closed.
Mm.
And temperatures were like negative 35. And the president of our university was on a cruise in Florida, making students walk to class. And the emergency management folks were sending out tweets saying, hey, there's hot chocolate in the union. You just got to walk to it.
Right.
To get to it. So I'd say currently, by the numbers, it's not as cold. And I ran my own little experiment this morning. I put out a cup of water to see how quickly it would freeze. And in 2014, I threw a bottle of water outside, and it froze instantly. This time around, the bottle of water that I threw outside froze in about 5 minutes. So, I mean, it's still cold, but it's not as cold as it was last
right.
time. And it's not as bad as Chicago, for sure.
Well, Tushar, thank you for your call and for your warning there to students to stay indoors. Much appreciated. I mean, since Tushar mentioned the past polar vortex a couple of years ago, let's turn to an expert on this climate phenomenon. Joining us now from Boulder, Colorado, is Amy Butler. She's a research scientist at the University of Colorado's Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences. She works at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where she researches climate variability. Amy Butler, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna. I'm so glad to be here.
Okay, so first of all, can you just give us a quick explainer about what the polar vortex is and how it brings such profound cold down from northern latitudes?
Sure. The polar vortex is a regular feature of our wintertime atmospheric circulation. It forms every year, so there's nothing unusual about it. It describes the winds that flow west to east around the polar cap in the stratosphere. Now, the stratosphere is a region 6 to 30 miles above the surface, and this polar vortex can influence the winds and weather patterns closer to the surface it actually can cause the jet stream to weaken and become wavier, and that allows these cold air to be transported from the Arctic down into the middle latitudes.
Okay, so the polar vortex influences the jet stream. I had been, I guess I was wrong in thinking that it was the other way around, that it was changes in the jet stream that were allowing the cold air to come down south.
Yeah, well, it's a coupling. So the troposphere weather can actually influence the polar vortex first, and then that can influence us later. But in general, what's happened in this case is that we had this polar vortex in the stratosphere, and it split apart at the beginning of January. And this happens pretty regularly, about once every other year. And when that happens, it can essentially allow colder outbreaks at the surface to occur up to 2 months later. So it gives us an idea of when we're going to see these cold extremes.
Okay, but maybe this is just sort of the limited view of individual human experience. It does seem as if we're seeing them more often at lower latitudes than perhaps we were before. I mean, you're saying that it's a normal and regular phenomenon, but you know, it's just been what, 3 or 4 years between these giant polar vortexes that are really having an impact on tens of millions of people.
Right. So what I want to make clear is that, first of all, there's really two features that I'm describing here. One is in the stratosphere, and that vortex happens every year, and it's always there. But then there's a tropospheric vortex that is affected, and that we've been seeing more people aware of these cold air events at the surface.
Okay, so we're going to talk more. We'll let you tell us more about why when we come back from a quick break. That's Amy Butler. She's a research scientist at the University of Colorado's Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences. She's an expert on climate phenomena such as the polar vortex. And we want to hear from you. Are you enduring and suffering through these bone-chilling, record-breaking cold temperatures across much of the Midwest? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the polar vortex, which is blanketing the Midwest in record-breaking cold temperatures, the coldest seen in a generation in some places. With wind chill, we're seeing temperatures perhaps forecast to be around minus 60. And we want to know if you're experiencing it and how you're enduring it, and if you feel if your town, your city, your region is ready for these cold temperatures. Here is a Michigan native who posted a YouTube video about her experience trying to brave the bitter cold wind.
This is oppressive, bitter cold. Boy, that first shock of that cold that burns your face and it hurts when you breathe, you just can't get used to that.
So that's a Michigan native on a YouTube video here. Officials, of course, are strongly encouraging people not to go outside if they can do anything to prevent that, because it's so cold. We're seeing warnings of potential instant frostbite. Sheila Collins Bourgeoisie from Michigan is sending us this message on Facebook saying the governor has declared a state of emergency. Schools are closed, including the University of Michigan, and warming centers are open. Cindy Storm from Eau Claire, Wisconsin says it's going to be minus 27 tonight. Stock up on food and beverages and stay indoors. And on our website, onpointradio.org, forecast is saying staying safe in these conditions goes beyond the moment. Once things warm up, bridges will need to be checked to ensure their structures are still able to handle what they were built for. Roads will weaken and potholes will quickly form. So the effect on critical infrastructure, an important point there as well. Amy Butler joins us today. She's a research scientist at the University of Colorado's Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences. And Amy Butler, before the break, you were talking about sort of the differences between the polar vortices in different levels of the atmosphere. I hope I got that close to being right.
Yes.
Or
you
not.
Did.
You can tell me now if that's okay.
No, that's exactly right. So the point is that scientists in general have been referring to the polar vortex in the stratosphere, but because they cause these colder outbreaks in the troposphere, the term polar vortex has been somewhat adopted to explain this cold weather outbreak. But it's really just a part of our weather system that we get. Sometimes we get these cold extremes due to these lobes of the jet stream that get separated from the main flow and bring down these very this very cold air.
Okay. So here's the key question then. How related is the phenomenon that we're experiencing now, how related is it to climate change?
Yeah. So what's been interesting is that there is some agreement that over the past 30 years or so, the polar vortex in the stratosphere has weakened somewhat. However, what's less clear is whether that's been caused by climate change, in particular sea ice loss, or whether it's just some longer-term variability. And one of the reasons that we wonder whether it's really forced by increased greenhouse gases is because the climate models running into the future do not see significant or agreed-upon changes in these cold air outbreaks occurring more often. In fact, they overwhelmingly see that we'll experience fewer and fewer cold air outbreaks into the future.
Fewer and fewer. Okay.
Yes.
Can you help explain that? I mean, to be perfectly honest, I feel like I'm not quite caught up with you on why that might be. So could you explain that?
Yeah. So in general, the response to when you put more CO2 into the atmosphere, you're going to warm the atmosphere. And that's going to be true in all seasons and in winter as well. And what some people have proposed is that maybe because you're also melting sea ice, that can weaken the jet stream and you get some more of these cold air outbreaks. But whether the models just don't have these processes modeled correctly, or whether this really isn't going to be a big influence, we generally don't see any weakening of that vortex in these climate models.
Okay, because I guess what I'm saying is, as you almost certainly know, every time we have one of these extreme cold weather events, there are people out there, including the President of the United mm-hmm. States, who say, you know, like global warming or climate change, what gives? Like, how can we have these extreme cold events if we also have climate change? But are you saying that there is some
right.
kind of relationship between the two?
I'm saying it's possible. It's an interesting idea. I think it's a area of science where there's not a lot of consensus right now in terms of what will happen in the future with climate change and cold air outbreaks. In general, I think there's going to be less cold extremes than there are, but the weather is noisy, and so you're still going to have these very cold extremes occur on occasion.
Okay.
It's just going to be fewer and fewer of them.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's go back to our callers. We are talking about that polar vortex and the record-breaking cold temperatures that much of the Midwest is experiencing today, and we want to hear from you about how you're handling it. How you're experiencing it, what your concerns are. Maybe are you enjoying it? I don't know. Let's go to Chris, who's calling from Adams, Wisconsin. Chris, you're on the air.
It's minus 50 here with the wind chill, just so everybody knows. We actually had a little burst of this kind of weather 5 years ago, and I was living out on a farm. And we had a young llama. One would think a llama would be safe from this kind of stuff. It had a shelter, but it froze to death overnight outside. So I would like to recommend to everybody and remind them, do not leave your pets outside and help take care of the wildlife. I've been feeding the birds furiously. I have a bowl of cat food out in my garage, which has the door cracked for the feral cats in the neighborhood. And you can also help feed the wildlife. I have a friend in northern Michigan that has wild turkeys, and she's been feeding them. The deer are going to have a problem because we've got 18 inches of snow on the ground, and they're not going to be able to forage. So if you've got bales of straw, throw it out for the deer, and just try and be aware that all the creatures on the planet are having a hard time with us, not just us. And what I did is I'm a gourmet cook, so I went out and bought about $200 worth of wonderful, fabulous food, and I am hunkered down and cooking and having a fabulous time. So,
well, Chris, thank you so much for your call, and I appreciate your positive outlook on this and your great advice. Thank you, Chris. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Springfield, Illinois. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello there, Megan. Great weather we're having, isn't it?
Hope you're hanging in there, Jim.
I'm having a good time. I slept in my truck last night. I'm from Chicago. I'm down here, and I just not want to spend money on motels. In fact, I like Chris. I want to go visit her, and I like to hunker down and eat gourmet food, too. But I went through the negative 27 degrees. In fact, we went to Wilmot back in 85. I'm a scout leader from way back, and I taught winter camping survival skills. So we did a lot of winter camping and stuff like that. So the most important thing I can say to everybody is layers and make sure you keep all the exposed skin covered. I mean, if I went out wearing gloves like last night just for something to get out of the back of the truck, because I've got a pickup truck, and I got in the bed, I had to open the gate up, and didn't have one glove on, and within 10 seconds I could feel the tingling out of it. So you got to stay hydrated. You got to wear layers. And just stay warm. We're in the truck 5 minutes every hour, and I'm good enough. But we went to Wilmot. I was in a group of people who had a ski trip planned for that night, January 20th of 85. And they closed the mountain, Wilmot, up in Wisconsin. And I had two pairs of long underwear, snowmobile suit, and a coat, and two hats, and gloves, and mittens over those. And I walked around up on the hill. It was like 8 o'clock at night, and they couldn't get the body of the ski, so I slid down my back. So
yeah.
The thing is, you just got to enjoy it. You know, this is the people that aren't prepared don't know. Those are people you got to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
Governor Pritzker did declare a state of emergency here too. So you know, that's all three states. I think Wisconsin and Illinois
and Michigan. That's right. Well, Jim, hang in there, and I really appreciate again your advice about trying to be positive about this, enjoy it, but be smart as well. And I'm hoping you're not going to sleep in your truck again. So, Jim, thank you so much for your call. Amy Butler, stand by here for just a second. I want to introduce into the conversation Rick Garnett. He's joining us from Notre Dame, Indiana. He's a professor at Notre Dame Law School and a native Alaskan, though. And normally we talk to Rick about, say, Supreme Court nominees, but today we are going to talk with him about the weather. Rick Garnett, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much.
So what's it like where you are right now?
It's clear and pretty and very cold. We're told it's about 45 below with the wind chill, about 20 below air temperature. It's quiet. Nobody's on the streets. We were told to stay off. And really, only the second time I can remember in my 20 years at the university, even the University of Notre Dame shut down. So the vortex got the better of the Fighting Irish, it looks like.
Mm. And so, I mean, as we mentioned, since you're a native Alaskan, how does what you're experiencing there in Indiana now compare to what you grew up with?
Yeah, it's, childhood memories. I looked it up to try to confirm the coldest that I remember as a kid, and I think it was 35 below. So this is not quite getting to there. But, one of the things you do learn in Alaska is that frostbite's no joke, and the layers work. And so I've been trying to tell that to my friends and my children just to be sure and take this kind of thing pretty seriously. The risk is people go outside, and the first 30 seconds or so, they feel like it's no big deal, and they don't realize that exposed skin gets bit really quickly with these kind of temperatures.
Yeah, do you think that that people have been adequately prepared this time around?
I think the local businesses and the university and the city are doing all they can to try to educate people and keep them informed. At some point, you can't stop people from doing silly things like going outside in their jammies and throwing boiling water to watch it turn into crystals. But hopefully, the students know that the fact that school's canceled doesn't mean they should party in the snow. And hopefully people are staying warm. I know the city's done a good job of trying to set up warming centers for people who don't have any place to go. So I think we're pretty well prepared. This has happened before, but it's definitely serious business. I've got two hair dryers going to try to unfreeze some pipes in the basement.
Yeah.
But hopefully that'll work.
is two hair dryers going to be enough?
We'll see.
Okay, well, Rick Garnett, best of luck to you. He's a professor at Notre Dame Law School trying to unfreeze his pipes in the basement today as Notre Dame is closed down. Thanks so much for being with us, and good luck, Rick.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Amy Butler, let me turn back to you. Is there, I mean, we were talking to Tom Skilling, the meteorologist at WGN in Chicago earlier, about how long this polar vortex may last. And he said, you know, not that long, that later this week they expect a 40 to 60 degree swing to warmer temperatures. Is that normal for a polar vortex like this? Because they can last quite a long time.
Yeah. So what's happening is that for the past month, a lobe of the polar vortex has been sitting over eastern Canada, and that sort of pushed this cold air south over the middle of the United States. But starting this weekend, that lobe is sort of rejoining with the other lobe that's currently over more Siberia. And so they're coming together. The vortex is re-strengthening. And so the east coast will start to warm up a bit. But the cold is expected to at least have a chance of occurring all through February.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's hear from more from people who are living this right now. Ariane is joining us from, is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. You're on the air.
Hello. You had questioned whether or not anybody was actually enjoying it. And while I don't mean to make light of the danger that it is as a woman of a certain age, approaching 50, there are many moments throughout the day that I'm actually grateful to be able to step outside and cool off.
Oh, you know what? I you made me laugh there, Ariane, and thank you so much, because I really appreciate the positive attitude that people are taking, even as we all acknowledge that these are dangerously cold temperatures. But Ariane, thank you so much. Let's go to Richard, who's calling from Superior, Wisconsin. Richard, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm out using my car as a bird blind, and I'm actually watching a snowy owl hunt right now. And when it plunges to the snow, I pop out of the car and take a few photographs.
And how long are you able to stay out of the car, Richard?
Oh, probably not much more than 10 minutes. I've got lots of layers on. I live up here in the Northland, so I'm used to this cold, but saw something even crazier yesterday when it was just a little bit cooler. There's this race called the Arrowhead 135 that goes from International Falls, Minnesota, to Lake Vermilion, which is near Ely. And people bike, hike, ski 135 miles, and they're still out there today. They have a limit of 60 hours, and I watched that yesterday.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, they are hardier folk than I am, but that doesn't strike me as being terribly smart, though. I mean, like, we're hearing about these temperatures. Like, what if you're that could cause instant frostbite? You wouldn't even know that you'd been hurt.
They have every inch of skin covered up.
Yeah.
They have very specialized equipment. But let's just put it this way. When they come into a checkpoint, they look like Frosty the Snowman.
Wow. Well, toughness there for sure. Richard, thank you so much for your call. Let's take one more here. Let's go to David, who's calling from Goldsboro, North Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a friend who's traveling to Minneapolis, St. Paul, to visit his son and his son's girlfriend on Thursday. And I'm wondering, what are the chances they may close the airport? Is it going to be really bad still on Thursday? Or, you know, how bad is it going to be for him?
All right. Well, David, thank you so much for your call. Amy Butler, let me just turn back to you. Do we have a sense that the depth of this cold is going to last all the way until tomorrow or perhaps even Friday?
Well, I'm not a meteorologist, so I'm not going to give any forecasts. But it's only supposed to last maybe 48 hours, so it should be moving on pretty soon here. But
yeah, I would say that, and this is just for me as a layperson, that whenever weather interrupts travel, even if it's just for a day, you probably ought to presume that there will be knock-on effects from that interruption for a couple of days. So that's just all the advice that I have to give to people. But Amy, we have about 45 seconds left here in this segment. And when we come back, we're going to talk about national parks and the government shutdown. But I just wanted to ask you quickly, sort of as an aside, I mean, you also work for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. You know, in about 30 seconds, you want to just talk quickly about how did the government shutdown affect your research and the work that NOAA is doing?
Well, so I'm a Cooperative Institute employee, so I was still getting paid and studying this phenomenon. But a lot of my data is stored at NOAA, so that certainly impacted my ability to address the phenomenon. But now we're back and we're at work and we're going to be looking into this carefully.
All right. Well, Amy Butler, a research scientist at the University of Colorado's Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences. And as I said, she also works at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where she studies climate variability and things like the polar vortex. Thank you so much for joining us today, Amy.
Thank you.
And folks, if you're experiencing these truly sub-sub-sub-zero temperatures, just be smart and stay safe. When we come back, we'll talk about the government shutdown and national parks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. America's national parks are an unrivaled gem, but the already fragile ecosystems were made even more vulnerable during the historic government shutdown. You might have already heard about the trash and the overflowing toilets, but the parks also lost critical income as well, and some observers are saying that the damage could be even worse than that. For example, at California's Joshua Tree National Park, damaged trees may take more than 300 years to recover. So let's talk about what happened to the national parks during the shutdown. And joining us first from Joshua Tree, California, is David Smith, the superintendent for Joshua Tree National Park. David Smith, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Meghna. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, also with us from Washington is John Garter, the Senior Director of Budget and Appropriations at the National Parks Conservation Association. John Garter, welcome to you.
Hello, Meghna. Thank you.
And folks, we want to hear from you. Did you visit a national park during the government shutdown? What did you see? And what's your reaction to this idea that it could take some of the parks centuries to recover? David Smith, let me start with you for a couple of minutes here, because you're the superintendent at Joshua Tree National Park. Tell us, I mean, there's been a lot of coverage over the past day about the damage done there, but specifically, what have you seen in terms of the condition of the park?
Well, Meghna, it could have been a lot worse. You know, we had, I would say, hundreds of people from the local community, from Los Angeles, from San Diego, that were coming up to just volunteer to take care of the park. So they were the stewards that, you know, cleaned out the toilets and put in toilet paper, and they advised people when they saw them doing things that typically aren't allowed, like having dogs off leash and driving off road, just to not do things like that. So if not for the volunteers that we had in the local community, I think it would be much worse. We began seeing damage inside the park probably, you know, a few days into the shutdown, and we were able to bring back a number of our park scientists and rangers to help document it and start mitigating some of the damage even during the shutdown. But I just got the final totals in yesterday from some of our scientists. We had about 24 miles of OHV use, so off-road vehicle use, inside the park, and a lot of it in wilderness areas as well. So that, you know, for me is one of the biggest long-term damages to the park, was the creation of new roads and the folks driving across the desert landscape. Luckily, because we were able to bring back some of our trail crew and uh-huh. science staff, we were out there raking those tracks, doing something that we call vertical revegetation, where we take dead plant matter and we kind of block off trails so folks don't see it and they're not apt to drive down those roads again and across the desert. And luckily, we had a big old rainstorm that happened just after Christmas. And so having wet soil and raking it out, you know, helps that microbiotic crust, that desert crust that helps kind of hold down the desert landscape.
Yeah.
It helps it to rebuild much more rapidly, so that hopefully my goal is that, you know, in a few months or a few years, you're not going to see a lot of those trails. Now, we haven't gotten to all of them yet, and I was out in the park yesterday with staff looking at some of the damage, and some of these trails go on for miles.
Wow.
Into the desert, and we've just not been able to send folks out there to begin raking them out.
So, David Smith, can I just jump in here for a second? Because, I mean,
sure.
you keep saying trails, but to be clear, these are tracks that weren't there before, right? That these are newly created tracks by vehicles that actually aren't allowed to drive where you're seeing the tracks.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
I didn't mean to imply that these were trails or roads. They become roads the more people that, you know, go down these sections of the desert.
Yeah.
You know, this area of California was used for desert training during World War II. And, you know, we still see some of those tracks from the 1940s down in the southern portion of the park because, you know, they didn't go back and mitigate the damage. But luckily, like I said, we were able to bring back a lot of our crews to do that.
Okay.
We've also been working a lot on illegal campsites. You know, folks were, you know, when they drove out into the desert, they would create their own campsite. So our crews went out there, you know, people created fire pits. They, you know, cut down acacias, you know, junipers and things like that for firewood. So we've been able to clean up most of those campsites to make them look as if they're pristine once again. But, you know, if you cut down a juniper, that takes 200-300 years for that plant to reach maturity. And we have three or four incidents of people, you know, damaging or destroying Joshua trees.
Yeah.
You know, those trees grow, you know, for 200-300 years before they die. I don't want to imply that, you know, there are large swaths of, you know, Joshua tree forests that have been cut down. It was truly just exceptional spots where they were damaged. It's not all over the place. And hopefully, you know, my goal today is, you know, if you are able to make it out to California and visit the park, it's going to look pretty pristine, like you'd expect your park to look.
Okay. Well, that's good news then. John Gardner, I'm going to come to you in a second, but David Smith, the superintendent at Joshua Tree National Park, one more question here for you, at least for now.
Okay.
The park is what, almost 800,000 acres, right? And so during normal operations, I presume it's adequately staffed to be sure to keep sort of visitors' behavior in check? Because it seems to me that, like, what happened that all of a sudden, simply because, you know, because of the government shutdown, that a park as vast as Joshua Tree National Park, we saw some bad behavior? Because I can't imagine that there's a ranger, of course, on every, you know, square mile of the park at all times anyway.
Oh, so I our visitors are tremendously wonderful stewards of the landscape generally. We don't typically have problems like this. But I was sitting around with some of my staff yesterday trying to figure out, you know, how we can deal with this in the future. And I think part of the problem was, you know, we didn't have our visitor centers open. You know, that's where we do our initial education and interpretation. You know, most of our visitors come from, you know, outside this area. They come from Europe. They come from back east. They're not used to just how fragile the desert can be. So we really education's one of the main things we do. You know, our entrance stations weren't staffed.
Yeah.
And so you didn't have someone to contact you to remind you, hey, you know, stay on the roads when you're here. Hey, if you have a dog, please keep your dog on a leash. You're inside of a national park where there's bighorn sheep and bobcats and mountain lions and things like that. So by not having those staffs operating in the visitor centers, by not having our entrance station staffed, by not having, you know, the 20 guys and gals who work maintenance inside the park, you know, they're out there in the campgrounds every day talking to people. Our trail crew, you know, they're building trails, but they're talking to people every day. By removing our entire workforce from the park during that time, there was no more education interpretation going on. Yeah, there are a few bad apples that showed up, and, you know, luckily we had enough rangers on duty during the shutdown. We were able to issue a fair number of citations with mandatory appearances, so, you know, folks they were educated that way. They were educated through the legal system, you know, not to take mm-hmm. your motorcycle and go cross country.
Yeah.
But that's kind of my summation.
Right. Well, David Smith, stand by here for a second. John Garter, you've been very patient, and thank you for that. Let me just turn to you here. As Senior Director of Budget and Appropriations at the National Parks and Conservation Association, give us the big picture here. I mean, what do you think the long-term effects of the historic government shutdown are going to be on parks like Joshua Tree?
Sure. Well, we're concerned, you know, that Joshua Tree is just one among a number of parks that have sustained damage. Some of which could last for a really long time, in particular with situations where cultural sites have been vandalized, where there are incidents of looting that the Park Service likely still doesn't know about as they go out and do these damage assessments. Certainly there are a lot of businesses that are suffering and other impacts that are of deep concern during any shutdown scenario. But one of our concerns that really alarms us is that the administration has really abdicated its authority to look out for the preservation of these places for current and future generations by creating a scenario that was predictable, leaving resources at risk, as David described, but in many other parks as well, and then adding insult to injury by prolonging that situation by instructing parks to use fee revenue that is critically needed for addressing deferred maintenance. There's now an $11.6 billion deferred maintenance in our national parks. Those fee dollars are critically needed for repairing visitor centers and trails and a lot of other projects that are important to visitors and resource protection. And they were instructed to vacate those accounts in order to prolong this damaging situation. And
right.
Over the coming days, superintendents and other park staff are going to be really assessing and finding other situations where there have been impacts to wildlife behavior, vandalism, not just trash and waste, that the things that people see, but a lot of other damage that is often invisible to visitors.
Well, so David Smith, as superintendent at Joshua Tree National Park, let me ask you, I mean, how much money did you have to defer from entrance fees that you had already collected before the shutdown to help, you know, that maintenance that John Garter was talking about?
Well, Meg, there's kind of two issues.
Okay.
You know, during the shutdown, we were unable to collect fees for the park. And we kind of plan our budget out, you know, for the next year to deal with those projects that John was mentioning, the deferred maintenance projects and the infrastructure projects that, you know, serve the visitor. So I just got the tally from our fee office. We had expected to bring in a little bit over $1 million, you know, during that time period. Christmas is a really busy time at the park here in Southern California because it's so nice. So that's $1 million that we didn't collect that we're going to have to really look at our fund for the next 8 months and decide, you know, what projects are we going to eliminate this year and, you know, which ones can we go forward with. The secretary gave us permission about, you know, a couple weeks into the shutdown to go ahead and use some of our fund sources that we already have and use those to pay the staff that we were bringing back. We were able to bring back initially about 60 people to deal with the campgrounds. We were having a health and safety issue because the sewage was at the top of the toilets and things along that nature.
Yeah.
So we had to deal with that immediately. So I brought back the whole maintenance division, you know, to work on that. And they were all paid for out of our Floria, our fee account to deal with that. We're still crunching the numbers, but I'm guessing probably about $200,000 to $300,000 we used to cover those wages during that time period.
Okay. Well, let's go take a quick call here. Let's go to Spencer, who's calling from New Orleans. Spencer, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say I had driven to Joshua Tree about 12 days ago from New Orleans, and we did get to go in and have a great time. There was a ranger there at the front gate handing out maps just like normal. Didn't take any fees or anything like that, but I wanted to thank you to all the rangers that were out there keeping maintenance of the parks and taking care of them.
All right. Well, Spencer, thank you for your call. And let's go to Tim, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say, and certainly it's clear the damage that have been done to the national parks, but when you look at this entire government system, it's really like an ecosystem. And if something is missing out of that ecosystem, if people suffer, you may not be able to see it, but it affects you down the line. And so I think not just the park system, but all the people that miss money during this period, it's going to affect them in ways that we don't see. And I think it makes us appreciate the government more to see what's going on.
Well, Tim, thank you for your call. John Garter, let me turn back to you because we've got another comment that's come in here on social media. Nina Brin says, this is on the users, not on the shutdown. Maybe we Americans lack a culture of the outdoors. We shouldn't need anyone there to tell us not to leave trash or feces lying around. What do you think?
Well, here's the thing. You really, there are obviously some bad actors, as David outlined, people who have clearly done purposeful damage, and that's extremely unfortunate and irresponsible behavior. But there are also a lot of visitors who cause unintended damage where they are not educated by the Park Service staff that are needed to engage in the kinds of behaviors that ensure not just their own safety, but that of wildlife and the integrity of park resources. And some people who may know they're doing things that they're not allowed to do, but don't realize the extent of the damage that's causing. The real situation is not so much pointing the finger at users, which, you know, it's really a matter of an approach to managing our national parks with only 13% of the Park Service staff out there. You need those people, those uniformed rangers who are out there educating people, ensuring that park resources are protected. You can't operate our national parks with such small staffing levels.
Yeah. Well, David Smith, you know, we have, what, maybe 2.5 weeks before there's the possibility, hopefully it won't happen, but possibility of another government shutdown. Are folks at Joshua Tree, are the rangers there trying to prepare for that possibility?
Well, they're professionals. You know, they came to the National Park Service because they love public service and they love taking care of national parks. So they are doing everything they can right now to mitigate the damage that occurred during the shutdown and to educate the public and reaching out to our partners to help out as much as possible if there were to be another shutdown or something like that. Our park association, you know, they volunteered to, you know, operate our visitor centers, you know, during the shutdown. And, you know, just having those exhibits there, having them giving out safety warnings and things like that, that would be, you know, that's a godsend to have folks to be able to do things like that. The businesses in the local community, I'm sure they are ready to jump to it again and start helping us with toilets and things like that. We're really trying to message to the public right now just how fragile the desert ecosystem is and just how important it is for folks to stay on the road. You know, if there is a shutdown, you know, pick up your garbage. You know, don't expect that someone's going to be there to pick it up. To use some of the common sense that to me is, I know because I've been working for the Park Service for almost 30 years, you know, you don't run your dog, you know, through wildlands where there's lots of wildlife. You don't operate a drone where it's going to harass, you know, birds that are up there. We just have to get those messages out.
Well, you know, David, if I might say, I may be based in Boston now, but I grew up on the West Coast, and I'm going to shamefully admit to the nation that I have never been to Joshua Tree National Park. It's an oversight that I have to fix. So I'm going to come out there soon, sometime, hopefully.
Make that you are my personal guest. I will make time, and I would love to show you the park and just how magical and special Joshua Tree
is.
Well,
the desert there is absolutely, as I said at the beginning of the conversation, part of our national park system, which is a gem, a true gem that the United States has that really distinguishes it from so much else in the rest of the world. So David Smith, superintendent at Joshua Tree National Park, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. You have a great day.
And John Garter, Senior Director of Budget and Appropriations at the National Parks and Conservation Association, with us from Washington. John Garter, thank you as well.
Thank you again, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.